Podcast with a K. Right, so are we just going to randomly ramble?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then. All right, I'll do an intro then. So
unless you want to do a 40-minute commentary one.
I can't because Kieran out. I've got the baby in front of the telly, basically.
Okay, right.
When I say
let's
in front
just do
of the
this.
Telly, I don't mean she's watching the telly. I mean that's why I put a crib because it's near the Amazon Echo where I was streaming blues music to put her to sleep.
Have you seen Labyrinth?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. Yes.
Well, they would be sort of popping out of the telly to actually grab her, but since sort of PBS is pretty much gone now, Muppets won't have anywhere to pop out of. Not that technically they were just on PBS anymore, but anyway.
Well, indeed, they're everywhere now. Anyway, in fact, recently I've noticed with the resurrection of John Major as a political quote force unquote. I noticed a strange resemblance to Kermit the Frog in him that I'd never noticed before. So yes, welcome to the podcast with a K, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Christian Corley, that is James McLean. We've, as you've probably noticed, taken a couple of weeks off, which wasn't intentional, but here we are. There's a new series of Doctor Who approaching us in 3 weeks now, which that's interesting. We might have to have a talk about that in a little while, about the fact that it is 3 weeks away and that excitement levels don't seem to be running to any kind of high temperature sweat or anything like that. What I wanted to start with was a kind of a Russell T Davies general topic. Because he's been talking a lot lately. I don't know if you've noticed this. He's been popping up in a lot of interviews.
No, I'd not noticed it at all.
There is an interview in today's Telegraph with Matt Cain, who's editor-in-chief of Attitude magazine, in which he talks to Russell T Davies about, basically, the quote is, gay people are more imaginative than anyone else. So there's that. I'm not going to go into that because I don't really have a point of reference. Although he does say that a new writer should bring back Queer as Folk. That was earlier this year he said that. But there was a nice interview with Russell T Davies on the BBC Writers website, Writers Room website, a couple of days ago, in which he talks about writing for television, basically. And I am going to move on to Doctor Who slightly in a moment, dear listener. But he did note that, and I think this is interesting because I think people need to Russell T Davies is the sort of person that people need to pay attention to and take notice of. And he basically said that soap operas have too many episodes.
Yeah.
And that TV companies should be wheeling them back to probably, I don't think he specified a figure, but I imagine he probably means 2 or 3 episodes a week, and spending money on sitcoms. Now this is a bugbear of mine, that the state of sitcoms in the UK, and it's probably not entirely the topic for a podcast with a K, but I'm going to be clever, in inverted commas. Peter Kay's Car Share is a phenomenally popular sitcom, and it's probably the most popular sitcom on BBC TV. And it's like, there's probably only one or two other really popular across-the-board sitcoms on BBC TV. All the others are little niche sitcoms. And, you know, niche is kind of not the way to go, as we've talked on the podcast with a K, with regards to Doctor Who in the past. And it seems strange to me that soap operas should be doing the opposite of going niche, whereas everything else is sort of retracting and regressing. You know what I mean?
It's an interesting topic.
It's not really the main topic that I was going to go for. I was actually going to say it's 12 years since Rose.
How boring.
Yes, I know. But you know, it is a strange thing that soap operas of all things, you know, things that in the history of TV essentially started off as commercials for soap powder, hence the name. They're like these big things that push forwards and dominate television and are being all inclusive, whereas things like sitcoms are sort of like regressing into little pockets on BBC Two or on the online BBC Three or whatever. You know, it's a very odd thing. How do we get to that state?
Well, I think the answer is that as television becomes sort of quite sort of narrow band in its sort of watching, you know, that we sort of have so many channels and people are watching on niche. For broadcasters, which inherently is what these sort of large institutions are of ITV and BBC One, they still remain broadcasting by definition. They're left with trying to keep people in by looking for things which carry sort of very broad output. And soaps do that. They've always been incredibly, well, certainly in this country for the last 30, 40 years, they've been a massive audience grabber. So I think that's probably why they're becoming so dominating, because they are perfect for broadcast, and they carry a popularity which keeps the main broadcasters in a position of viewing authority, I guess. So I think that's probably why they're extending. I wonder with the sitcom whether the sitcom is becoming quite hard to keep revitalized or keep, and maybe also that other genres sort of slip into sitcoms areas now, like dramas will often carry a lot of meta references. Doctor Who, for instance, although Doctor Who has always done it, to be fair, carries quite a certain element of comedy to its drama, to a point where some elements probably could be considered situation comedy. So maybe there's a bit of that as well, which is unseated what the sitcom is. And maybe the sitcom has diversified so much that what a sitcom is has possibly become a little less tenable. I've been watching on Netflix last couple of months, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is a very good American sitcom. At first, I wasn't sure I was going to like it, but what I noticed about it was so horrendously well written. Now, whether you find it funny or not, there's no doubt that the humor is very clever, very sharp, and it's just beat by beat. It's just bang, 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 bang of jokes. Maybe sitcoms are becoming such an art that it's kind of hard to keep up with that sort of level of intensity, especially with British writing crews of two people. I don't know. I mean, but then say Red Dwarf is a sitcom, which is, I mean, that's carrying on through its, it's got its longevity through its sort of history, I guess, is keeping it alive. But it is sort of hit the narrow audience. It's now on Dave as a sort of niche show.
Yeah,
it's not sitting really on the broadcasters. So sitcoms have migrated over as being something which is possibly either a bit retro or a bit niche, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think I can see the arguments for why soaps are continuing and why they're just flooding. But I can't quite see where the sitcom has gone per se.
Yeah, it's strange because, I mean, there's probably four, I think, British sitcoms. There's Citizen Kane. I was going to say Mrs. Brown's Boys, but that's not even British. But, you know, it's on BBC Primetime. For some reason, I'm not going to pass comment on Mrs. Brown's Boys. Not Going Out and Peter Kay's Car Share. Now, Not Going Out is probably the American-style comedy in terms of the number of gags that are in there. There's probably or four gags a minute. And Lee Mack's very good at doing that, so I'm not going to dismiss it or anything like that. I enjoy Lee Mack. I think he's a good comic. I think he's a very good stand-up. There's really only, I think, I know a lot of people like Mrs. Brown. As I say, I'm not entirely sure why, but I think really out of those four, the Peter Kay one's the only one I think that people will be rewatching in a few years' time.
I remember, is it actually a scripted situation? I've never seen it. I remember it being called, remember it coming out and it being mentioned, but I've never watched it.
Well, Carshare?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah.
It's scripted. I don't know. I mean, I kind of find it odd. I mean, when I watch sitcoms now, I mean, as I say, if I watch Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, or if I watch, I don't know. I mean, Big Bang Theory is very big in the States. Hmm. But I was going to say the sort of audience laughter sitcom seems to be dying a death, and to a point where at one point I always thought that it was quite good in a sense, because it gave a sort of, I mean, there's been books written about this, so it's not my area, but I kind of think that, I mean, one of the things that audiences bring is it's not just, I mean, people say, oh, it just tells you where to laugh. I think it's more than that. I think it's more about sort of articulating a sort of performance like theatre.
Because you're part of the audience, isn't it?
Exactly, because you're acknowledging, because a sitcom is by itself an acknowledgement that this isn't straight drama, that you're not meant to totally believe in it, that you are looking for you know, generic devices in there. You're not looking to try and believe this. You are to a degree, but you're also aware that it's not real because there's a comedy element there. There is an absurdity of some sort. And often that is scripted in, that you know, as you say, it's going to be, you know, jokes, beats per minute almost. So the audience is there in a sense because it gives you that feeling of the show hall, is it, of the pantomime, of the theatre. It's that feeling that it's not just you finding it funny, you're sort of laughing as an audience. Or a studio audience, as if you're there in the studio audience. So I understand why it's there, but lately, you know, when you get comedies which are so sharp and so fast that somehow you don't need the audience, or the audience would just really break up the pace. Suddenly, when you go back to audience laughter, it can sometimes feel a bit odd. And even Mrs. Brown's Boys, sort of, which I have no interest in, but I'm aware of, plays on this notion of acknowledging the studio audience, and that it's there, and you are sort of aware of that. You're hyper aware, or you're meta aware, or however you want to, it sort of breaks down these sort of conventions, sort of postmodernist stuff. So none of it is really played that straight. And even when you do see it played, it never seems to feel quite. I don't know. So maybe to some degree, the sitcom is in a sort of period of transition where it's had to sort of take a step back while it licks its wounds and tries to decide what it is.
Well, I do know something, and you know, we're miles away from Doctor Who, but at the same time, we've just had the Comic Relief Night in the UK, and it was bereft of Doctor Who, and it was bloody awful, to be honest with you. And I think the times when they've got Doctor involved with Comic Relief, they've kind of been like the standout highlights of, you know, that particular year's.
I must admit, if we're going, so I'm going to push this because we need Doctor Who in this, I think. And I think it is interesting that when Doctor Who has been included, and I can merrily include some of Moffat's stuff in this as well. So I was initially going to say, you know, because Moffat seems to pull Doctor Who out of Comic Relief, but there were periods where he did have it in there, and we're talking about like mini episodes rather than just, you know, using Comic Relief often to, or not Comic Relief, but Red Nose, Children in Need certainly has been used as a sort of like a promotion platform for the Christmas special or something.
Yeah. And there was the Curse of the Fatal Death back in 1999 as well.
And yeah, Curse of the Fatal Death. But that to me seemed always a very, I think as a producer, if you can somehow get Doctor Who in there, I think it's a really nice thing, because I think there's no doubt that Doctor Who does have this sort of synonymous relationship with the BBC. That is how people see it as a part of, well, effectively cultural heritage, because it is. And I kind of like it sort of being in there, not as a sort of Doctor Who, and I'm going to use what we said earlier, the Doctor Who critic or the Doctor Who fan, if you'd rather, but because it just feels it has a sort of level of absurdity to it that it fits quite nicely in with a Comic Relief without feeling it's having to necessarily subvert itself. Curse of Fatal Death might arguably have gone down that route, and I still can't make my mind on that. Some of it I really like, and some of it really irritates me. It's a really weird. How are you with the Curse of Fatal Death? I mean, we've talked about it before, but
yeah, we have. I don't mind it.
There's some really
It's got some good stuff in it. It's got some nice ideas in it. I think the thing is, if Doctor Who hadn't come back, it would have aged better than it has. Because a lot of it has been reused.
Yes.
In Moffat's era of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking at it, it's basically like watching a spoof of modern Doctor Who. Nearly 20 years before modern Doctor Who.
I find it odd because it's in two parts usually, as it was on the night.
Yeah.
And the first part seems to be a very strong bit of using Doctor Who as humour without actually ridiculing Doctor Who. And I really like that bit. It's the second part,
second half,
I think.
It's not the
wind gags but it's the things like sort of the regenerations and the use of the Daleks and the sort of way it's mocking the sort of tied up you're going to die Doctor jokes, and it just feels like it's mocking the show, while the first part seems to be quite clever. It's sort of using the show to make new gags and nudging a little I mean, things like there's that lovely bit in the opening where you have the master sort of mocking him on the speakers and turning the voice off. But yeah, that sort of thing works really well because it's not really mocking the master. That's never sort of happened particularly. It's mocking the sort of trope of the vainglorious, arrogant villain and sort of subverting that. But it's not doing that to the actual show. So that sort of works for me. And the sort of thing of the constant pit falling down the pit thing, again, it's nothing to do with the master. It doesn't really mock him. It plays with time and it does it in a sort of ludicrous and slightly childish way. That works. So yeah, to me, it's a really weird piece of writing. The first part seems really smart and quite affectionate Doctor Who and sort of mocking the genre again, more than Doctor Who. Well, the second part just seems like what you'd expect. You'd expect from a Lenny Henry show or a Tracy Ullman show or anything mocking Doctor Who in the past, you know, 50 years. So, yeah, it's a weird one. But yeah, the first bit is really good. And I was watching, which was it Comic Relief or Children Need? They did the that quite clever Moffat one where he has the TARDIS land within the TARDIS and they do the whole with Amy and Rory.
I think that was Comic Relief.
I can't remember now. But that's quite, and that's a nice use where you're playing a serious, you know, a serious bit of drama with a very heavy comic overtones, which is, you know, inherently what a sitcom can be, i.e. Red Dwarf. And that really works. It's a really nice little piece, apart from the rather the sort of beta male writing of Amy sort of fancying herself, which is just a little like, oh, stop it. It's just a bit, you know, stop rubbing your trousers, people. Just get over that. But apart from that, it's a nice little bit of writing.
Interestingly, Doctor Who has a long history with Comic Relief, beyond what we've just been talking about. Back in 1991, Fleetway Publications released the Comic Relief comic, a 60-page full-color multi-character linked series of strips which featured various people. The Doctor Who script strip, which is believed to have been written by John Freeman. The art was by John Ridgway, and the overall plot was by Richard Curtis, Neil Gaiman, and Grant Morrison. It features the strip told of the Doctor's arriving to save the day, I'm quoting from Wikia here, with a supply of red noses for the Treen colony when Dandare runs out and the Mekon isn't happy. It's an absolute cavalcade of different fictions. 1985.
I don't either.
That was 91. Prior to that, in 85, Colin Baker did an in-character cast. I think 85 was the first Red Nose Day, wasn't it?
84, 85. Yeah,
Colin Baker was in-character, urging people to donate to the famine crisis in Ethiopia. 1999 was spoken about. 2007 was David Tennant and Catherine Tate, with Tennant as the teacher, Mr. Logan, and Catherine Tate as Lauren Cooper, which was again a standout Comic Relief night sketch. 2009, from Max Okorica, Follow Pretorius with Love, a mini episode of the Sarah Jane Adventures with Ronnie Corbett, which I'd forgotten about, but
I vaguely remember that.
Now he's coming back to me. 2011, two mini episodes, Space and Time, starring Matt Smith, Karen Gillan, and Arthur Darvill, and then. In 2013, I missed this one. I think I'm glad about. Matt Smith appeared as the Doctor in a comedy sketch which combined elements of Doctor Who, Call the Midwife, and One Born Every Minute.
Yeah. Is that the one with Anton Deck in it as well?
It might be.
I think I saw a shred of it the other night.
Yes, I'm vaguely aware of that. But so... Yeah, it's and then there's the Children in Need stuff at the other side, which you know there's the time crash thing by Stephen Moffat. That was a Children in Need one, wasn't it?
I was going to say, why not Children in Need? Five Doctors obviously aired in that slot back in this
1983,
was it? Yeah.
The day after it'd been on telly in Australia, I think I'm right in saying.
Yes. So yeah. But that, I mean, I think that is, again, as I say, because Doctor Who has an absurdity and it has a comedy element and pretty much has done since, what, could you, it'd be something you could actually argue over, wouldn't it? Maybe Troughton?
I would say probably Troughton. I would, you know, I think possibly the initial feeling is probably Douglas Adams era. But then if you think about it properly, it's got to be Troughton.
Yeah, I would say Troughton. I mean, the absurdity is in there for Troughton. I would say it's in there a little for Pertwee. I'm never quite sure if Pertwee realises it, but but yeah, I would say definitely Troughton.
I think with Pertwee, that's not fair, is it? You know, that unit gets their own sort of moments of comedy, but that doesn't really happen until Series 8, because, you know, Season 7, they are a straight-laced military outfit, aren't they? And then Series 8, they're Dad's Army.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if there's anything in Season 7 which is... Season 7's fairly straight, isn't it?
Yeah, it is fairly straight. And really, there's, you know, having a shower in Spearhead is a little bit amusing, but there isn't much more than that.
Yeah, no, that's about it. He's not. Same time, there's a couple of things in there. There's a little sort of idioms in there, like his shoes bit in Spearhead when he sort of demands his shoes in a childish way. I mean, again, that's very Troughton, though. So you're still sort of... I would say Troughton is the beginning of the comedy, and almost straight away, if you think of Power of the Daleks, he's almost straight... They start immediately looking at him as an absurd character, which... is interesting because Hartnell was never really an absurd character. He was quite a straight character, quite a straight character type. And yet, as soon as Troughton comes in, it's a very early sort of awkward absurdity. It's as if it's very aware of the absurdity of the situation, changing character. And the only way they seem to play it off is to play him as sort of slightly unusual. I just can't think of anything really particularly before that where Hartnell was that.
Well, no, because he had that. The any moments of comedy, the very clear moments of comedy, aren't they, with Hartnell? So
absolutely,
there's nothing whimsical or absurd in the Hartnell era, no, other than the concept and maybe things like that. The mechanoids, or whatever.
I mean, yeah. Suddenly, in the first episode,
Daleks hiding in the sand.
Yes, and you know.
Well, that's the chase, so I think we can leave that aside.
But yeah, I mean, the bits of actual comedy in the Hartnell era are very childish and very pronounced. You know, often with some sort of musical accompaniment just to remind you that this is meant to be funny. But with Troughton, that first episode, you have. You know, like the recorder comes out, which, you know, most Doctor Who fans / critiques will sort of just be used to thinking about. But when you actually consider it as the first point of his character, where he has a recorder, which isn't something which heroes of shows normally tended to play, and certainly not... He is automatic. Then obviously you have his hat, which is not absurd per se, but it is very different. And he is sort of quite hobo-ish in his first costume too. And he's very eccentric in the first few scenes too, far more so than Hartnell was. So from their point on, you're sort of playing a little bit, you're playing up the absurdity, which seems to stem from almost like a subconscious or awkwardness over the sheer absurdity of changing the actor like that.
Yeah. Well, if you fast forward 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
Sticking with the recorder.
Yeah.
And the three doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, I've always wondered how it managed to, you know, get stuck where it got stuck. but moreover, there's a lot of absurd elements to the Three Doctors, isn't there? There's that whole psychedelic sort of juxtaposition of it almost Python-esque or Goodies-esque with those just random office items dropped in a quarry. You half expect a giant Dougal. Or John Cleese to pop up and say now for something completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a sort of absurdity, and obviously you've got the Cromer and the Brigadier, which is again played. I'm trying to think. I mean, the season before that, how much comedy was there in there? I mean, we're talking what, Terror of the Autons. There were moments of. I mean, obviously, comedy can sometimes be built as soon as you start establishing character dynamics, and then you start and something is serial, some of the comedy comes from the way that those sort of character dynamics become very reinforced. So things like the Brigadier and the Doctor naturally start to become a little more overplayed because they come, they're common, they're recycled, they're acknowledged, the audience is expecting them, and so they start to become in themselves a little more, not farcical, but not even necessarily sent up, but slightly more jovial. They become almost affectionate. And so by the Three Doctors, you very much have that with the Doctor and the Brigadier. But yeah, I mean, again, with the Three Doctors, is it Troughton which sort of creates that? Because as you say before that, I mean, Pertwee's is a very straight-laced Doctor. There's occasional moments where I suppose, a bit like Hartnell would do, to be fair. Almost Pertwee is almost a callback to Hartnell in a lot of ways. He's very straight, and occasionally he'll say things or do things which aren't quite as brusque or as action orientated. He'll come and say something quite gentle and calming in the same way Hartnell.
Yeah, because I mean, Hartnell was quite happy to sort of cozy up to the establishment, wasn't he, in the Aztecs or in the French one.
But he'd have a very sort of bold and a sort of hard facade, which would always melt, especially after the first season. Would melt when he's with his when he's very protective over his companions, especially if they're young girls. He'd have that sort of grandfatherly figure. I need to reinforce there. That's the sort of vibe he sort of gave, and sort of Pertwee sort of carried that as well. Yeah, he was quite a brutal, harsh character, except to the companion, except to his assistant, where he'd be quite gentle and sweet, and a little sort of amused by the sort of the Bentons and the Yates, and sort of irritated by the establishment.
But he would happily, you know, we get the impression, and it's something that the novelizations expanded on, or not the novelization. Well, yeah, to some extent the novelizations, but more particularly the Missing Adventures from Virgin and BBC, that he was quite happy to sort of hobnob with the establishment in his spare time. And, you know, there's the whole thing with him having a house.
Yes.
And, you know, going attending clubs, gentlemen's clubs, presumably, you know, quaffing sherries. And there's, you know, there's the scene in Day of the Daleks, isn't there, where he's checking out the cellar.
Which is always quite nice about those sort of books, is because they sort of react to those sort of natural things. Because he was anti-establishment. That was the whole point for me. He sort of rejected the military. He rejected the way the Brigadier worked things. He certainly rejected hierarchies of institutions. He loathed governments and politicians. And at the same time, as you say, he was in the show very happy to sit back and sip the very best wine that would only be cultivated by those hierarchies who would have the power and the money to spend on that sort of large wine cellar. But he was really at home there. He really liked those wine cellars. So quite logically, if he had his own establishment, having to think he was going to have to stay there for 18, 90 years, you could see him getting a house and wanting to get his own wine cellar, which again sort of brings him into that sort of establishment hierarchy. You know, you can't totally be against the thing which you actually sort of value. And he does a value sort of, you know, the high-end material, you know, whether it's artifacts or, well, you know, beautiful art, or whether, as you say, it's beautiful, tasty wine and great food. He loves to sort of show that he's got an understanding of that high-end quality and of the nuances, which comes from that establishment which he loathes. So, yeah, I think that is a really fascinating point with him. I had not really thought about that before. But it's, and that is very much Pertwee's Doctor. And it's interesting to say, what does that mean to us? Because that is something which is interesting, isn't it? Is that he is anti-establishment. He is a liberal character. And yet at the same time, he has this sort of... we see from him the fact that he's intelligent and he is experienced comes from is signified by these sort of very establishment-focused acts. You know, he'll know a good wine.
Yeah.
He'd be able to tell you a good sculpture, a good piece of artwork. It's, you know, education. It's all very highbrow, high end.
Well, I think he's riffing off a couple of things, isn't it? I mean, what it means in terms of the Doctor's character, I'm not entirely sure at this point. But it's obviously, I mean, there's the James Bond parallels with Pertwee's Doctor. But there's also the whole, everything that was going on in the ITC set of dramas at that time as well. With, you know, the Protectors and Persuaders and the whoever and the so-called... You know, they're all doing the same thing. They're all, you know, urbane chaps with high culture, whilst fighting crime.
Mm.
So he's not alone in that.
No, certainly not.
TV. What does it mean, the character of the Doctor? It's funny because, you know, like 2 years later, we find that the Doctor has escaped Gallifrey because it's basically a club full of old men.
Yeah.
So it is a strange one.
I mean, is it? Could you argue it's a sort of not an intended allegory, but you think of old men in political establishments normally come from university backgrounds who would have spent their youth drinking, cavorting, fraternities, you know, hazing, all that sort of thing, all those sort of rejections of establishment for their own establishments, or even rejections of that, and you can go into sort of what we'd call hippie culture and sort of coffee cafe bars, drinking, not, you know, getting up at the right time, being political in a sort of activist way rather than sort of looking to defend the establishment. But then as life goes on, as they sort of become part of that establishment through work or through family and having to sort of settle down, they sort of become part of that sort of establishment that they were fighting against. You know, as a Doctor on that sort of pathway, that at 450 years old, he is very anti-establishment. He's very sort of youthful, but as he gets older, he would eventually sort of fall into, if he'd stayed on Gallifrey, or if he gets back to Gallifrey, he would quite happily fall into line when he's about 3,000 years old, and he's sort of seen everything, enjoyed everything, and just wants to reflect and just have an easy, comfortable life in his frail old body.
Or is it simply a reflection of a British family on holiday in Benidorm having an English fry-up in an English pub in Spain?
Which bit is that?
Well, you know, you go on holiday, the Doctor's exiled to Earth, you're in Spain. You're feeling a little bit homesick, so you go and have a full English breakfast.
Oh,
or the Doctor
see.
Goes
see.
To John's
That's nice.
Pub.
That's nice. But then I would sort of argue to you, if we talk about Moffat's sort of perception, and we have the curator at the back end of his life as Tom Baker, is that him sitting in a comfortable establishment role, looking after artwork, sitting in decadence? You know, has he made that journey to the Gallifreyan establishment? Is he just an errant, angry schoolboy who goes on adventures and eventually will settle down? And maybe they're all like that. Maybe all those Gallifreyan lords you see in The Deadly Assassin have all done exactly the same thing as the Doctor through time. It's just they're sort of thousands of years older than him, and they've settled down after a while, and they've just calmed down. And they're just saying, well, God's sake, Doctor, you're there. You're making all this thing about the universe is in danger. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. And you all sit there doing nothing. But we all did that when we were young. You know, the Master's eternal. We've all fought the Master. You know, we've all done that back in the 60s. Master, yeah, and he comes around with his tissue compression eliminator and his stupid column TARDIS, and we have to defeat him. We did all that, and eventually you just get bored of it, and you realise the universe looks after itself, whether you're here or not, and we just sit down and we just decide what stupid head collar we're going to wear today. And, you know, that's how it goes. Maybe that is the route. And it's just we see the universe in Gallifrey and the world and the universe in danger through the Doctor's eyes. But ultimately, if he was there to stop Legopolis from falling, the universe would have corrected itself anyway. And, you know, all the Time Lords saw it on their scanners. Oh, look, Legopolis is entropy's increasing. Oh, don't worry. You know, it'll just. Oh, yeah, it sorted itself out. And they'd have just sat back. But no, the Doctor's got to be there involved and ends up probably hurting more people than he saves. Yes, it's interesting. Interesting ideas, this.
With Moffat, I wonder.
Moffat?
With Moffat and, you know, his. It just occurs to me that you could say that Moffat is a short form of the term Marrowfat. Anyway, no, with Moffat's curator, it occurs to me, what else is in that gallery?
Yeah?
Is there a whole set of sub adventures waiting to be told? By a retired Stephen Moffat, the adventures of the curator in his museum and all the works of art from all around the universe he's looking after in a sort of semi-Men in Black scenario.
I can hear the scratching pencils from Big Finish listening to this.
I can hear the scratching pencils
from Stephen Moffat.
From Shane Moffat. Hello, Stephen.
Well, he's not got long if he's going to go down that route. He's going to have to pick up the pace. Yeah, I mean... I don't know. I mean, what could be in his museum? It could be every one of his companions caught in a painting, screaming for release. The Doctor sitting there just going, no, you're happy there. He'll be with me forever. Would you like a jelly baby? Or maybe they are all in the shape of jelly babies. You know, maybe a star. That's what he does with companions after. That's maybe what all Time Lords do with the people that they love. They turn them into jelly babies, which means eating the jelly babies becomes a very disturbing thing.
It's already slightly disturbing as it is.
Ewan Chesterton, jelly baby.
I don't really know where this takes us as a podcast.
No. Can't say I do either.
Yeah.
About comedy, and yes. It's something about, I suppose it's about comedy and how absurdity or absurdities, reflections on Doctor Who and relationships of culture. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. I think possibly the best thing to do at this stage is to throw it open to our listener and to beg you, no, plead with you, suggest you, maybe, you know, any thoughts on this, just drop us a line on the Facebook page or via Twitter. You know, I mean, it comes, there must be more of it. There's some strange things going on in a few of the Peter Davison era stories. What the hell's going on during the Sixth Doctors? I don't know. Two Doctors, what the hell's that all about? I still don't know to this day. Through some of the McCoys, maybe not so much. Definitely very little comedy in the Christopher Eccleston era. I'm digressing slightly. Do drop us a line on this topic. We were going to have a few words about our feelings about Doctor Who Series 10, which is approaching rapidly. We'll maybe save that for another time.
Well, maybe. I mean, there's a few things that I think is worth reflecting on. There's a few things that have been said in our groups, which I was going to reflect on this week, but we haven't, about the continuity of Poldy, of his character's directions.
It's a good topic for our next discussion, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So that could be something we'll talk about just in time for 10.
Just in time for Series 10, that should be, yes. We'll be mixing things up with the format of the podcast and the video accompaniments over the next few weeks as well, so do keep a lookout for that. And just one last note, you've probably got it already, and if you haven't, then it's either because you're incredibly slow or you're not interested. However, I produced a video review of Vought Vop Issue 3. There is a text review on the Doctor Who Companion, who will be... I'm pleased to say featuring our podcasts, our Doctor Who podcasts, on their site from now on. So thanks to Phil and Andy over there. If you haven't got Vought Vop 3, please get hold of it, because there's going to be a time where there's no more copies. And you've got 200 pages of just a lovely produced fanzine, interviews with so many wonderful people from the world of Doctor Who comics. So, get hold of your copy of that. James and I will be back next time, I suspect, and we've still got the Flash Gordon podcast to bring to you as well.
And I've just released a podcast through Beyond Cerberus with John Kenneth Muir, which is out there if you haven't listened to that and you're interested in American 20th century television. We talk about that. So,
yes, point your dial isn't the right phrase. Point your mouse in that direction.
I don't know. I like point your dial. I think all right. It's point your dial retro in that vibe. Yeah.
Until next time, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.